Good morning to you all, and welcome to the 10th lecture of the 2017 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice New Zealand would like to thank and acknowledge the Genesis Oncology Trust for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded, and it will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware that there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speaker today, Dr. Oleg Karyev. Oleg is a palliative care specialist who works across the community and inpatient unit at Tutara Hospice South Auckland. He is also a geriatrician part of the community mental health service for older people team at Auckland DHB and a teaching fellow at the School of Population Health at the University of Auckland. Welcome, Oleg. Please go ahead.
So good morning, everyone. And welcome to the session on behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia, or BPSD for short. I've decided to title it Moving Towards a Better Approach, as I believe this is indeed what is gradually happening. There has been a growing awareness and re-evaluation of the needs of people with dementia, as well as the needs of people involved in providing dementia care. And this talk will touch upon the evolution of this awareness, especially as it relates to BPSD, and give a broad overview of both the present situation as well as opportunities for the future. Slide number two. Because this talk will be about awareness, I thought it might be useful to start by directly attending to the quality of awareness. I would like to invite each of you to take a moment to reflect on how we can begin this day with a grateful heart. Please take this time, make sure you're seated comfortably. Be aware of those around you, as well as the place you're sitting in. Become aware of your breathing, and become aware of your body. Become aware of your thoughts. I invite you to close your eyes if you wish, and share with me a brief moment's silence so that we may attend to ourselves. Thank you. Slide three. So the outline for this morning will first be a general overview of dementia, and that will really help to frame the urgency of need at a global level. I'll then move on to the deficits we commonly see in dementia and discuss how BPSD sits within this understanding. Next, I'll outline the basic parameters of BPSD before briefly talking on the pharmacological approaches and the very real limitations of these approaches. Was it Einstein who said the definition of insanity was doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result? Well, this really highlights some of the home truths about our current paradigms of dementia care, which will nicely segue into non-pharmacological therapies. Finally, having gained an understanding of where we've come from and the challenges we presently face, we'll briefly be able to glimpse into the future and the promises it may hold. And I think this might be a good place to finish things off for this morning. Slide four. I feel it's really important to mention from the outset that I've chosen not to focus on the actual assessment and treatment of individual components within the BPSD spectrum. Suffice it to say, the process can be complex with many caveats and cautions, and the best way I can describe it is that it's often like detective work. I'm not sure going through a list of symptoms and the treatment options is actually going to do any good. It might even give you the wrong impression as to the nature of the work, as it really is non-formulaic. There are very many good resources out there in Australasia, And these are available to freely download if you're interested in the topic. And truth be told, in all honesty, and I really shouldn't say this, but I'm not even sure we in our service, in mental health services for older people, actually do that well either, although there are pockets of excellent care. And I'm happy to expand upon this in question time if you're interested. Slide 5. So dementia really has become a pressing global issue. It was even raised in the G8 summit in 2013. Globally, there are 50 million people living with dementia, and this is set to double in 20 years' time. It currently costs $1 trillion worldwide and would rank as the 18th largest economy if it were measured as a country. It is by far the single biggest healthcare cost we face, larger than all other chronic illnesses and cancer. Slide 6. So the situation in New Zealand mirrors other OECD countries. And if you look at the graph on the right, you can see the reason dementia costs so much more than any other illness is because of the direct and indirect costs of providing care, as opposed to the cost associated with treating the illness. This is fairly unique to dementia and why the reason why it's such a pressing global concern. Slide 7. So when we think about dementia, we usually think of it in terms of losses, and indeed this is exactly how dementia is diagnosed. Losses in multiple neurocognitive domains leading to functional losses, which eventually reaches a threshold whereby we can confidently say this person has become unable to function at a minimally expected capacity. Slide 8. But dementia is much more than an illness of losses. There's a whole other side that we seldom appreciate, and these are the BPSDs. There are many different ways of categorizing BPSDs in various terminology used to describe particular phenomena. But this simple scheme that I've provided is as good as any. When we talk about BPSD, I guess we're referring to the behavioral changes such as apathy, aggression, and wandering, etc. We also have perceptual changes, including misidentification, hallucinations and delusions, and finally, mood changes, depression and anxiety. Slide 9. And this leads to a standard definition, which I've included for completeness sake. Slide 10. So the reason BPSD is important is because of the impact it has. It's recognized as being a greater determinant of carer burnout and patient distress than cognitive impairments. The fundamental changes carers experience in their relationships when faced with the loss of identity of their loved ones can be unbearable. We know the way they cope and respond can further exacerbate the BPSD itself. Even if well supported, carers still indicate the majority of their needs go unmet, and this all leads to a significant increase in their risk of mental illness, financial hardship, and poor quality of life. In regards to the patient, BPSD is known to accelerate cognitive and functional decline, and is the most important factor for premature institutionalization. Also, it may come as no surprise that they have a higher rate of restraint use, but they also have greater hospitalizations, and overall, their mortality is higher. Slide 11. So what factors are associated with BPSD? We know dementia is fundamentally a neurodegenerative process that leads to a person becoming increasingly vulnerable to stressors. And these stresses can be broken down into patient, carer, or environmental factors. In relation to patient factors, there's long been the thought that premorbid personality has some bearing, and it's intuitive to believe that dementia does lead to an overall coarsening and unmasking of basic temperamental traits. This hasn't really been borne out in research, though the strongest evidence does suggest premorbid neuroticism is correlated to the emergence of mood symptoms. There's also some suggestion that low premorbid agreeableness leads to aggressive behaviours, and premorbid extroversion is associated with wandering. In regards to acute medical conditions, there's a higher rate of undiagnosed illness, as well as pain disorders. And this is important as there's a clear association between pain and aggressive behaviours, as well as a very clear response to treatment with simple analgesics. With carer factors, as mentioned earlier, higher rates of carer distress itself influences the course of BPSD. And environmental factors really relate to the mismatch with the patient's needs. Right, let's move on. Slide number 12. And let's talk about prevalence. So unlike cognitive and functional deficits, which decline at a fairly predictable rate, BPSD can fluctuate and occur episodically over the entire course of illness. Even at diagnosis of dementia, a significant proportion of people are already experiencing BPSD. However, it's generally thought the prevalence is lower in the community compared to residential care, and this makes sense, though methodological issues means we don't really know what the true prevalence is. The other aspect of prevalence relates to the type of dementia, with various sub-syndromes being more commonly seen in certain types of dementia. The classic association we're all taught is vascular dementia, though there are also other typical behavioural syndromes we see with frontotemporal and Lewy body dementia. Slide 13. So this is a nice graphical representation that plots the longitudinal evolution against frequency. Each point marks the peak frequency and time of onset for the various behaviours. It nicely demonstrates that BPSD can occur many months before the diagnosis of dementia and shows how apathy, mood, wandering and irritability are encountered far more commonly than psychotic symptoms. Slide 14. So hopefully this is all making you ask whether individual BPSD symptoms naturally cluster together. One would naturally like to think so, and indeed clinically we find it useful because it fits within our pathophysiological understanding. But again, unfortunately, this has been hard to prove empirically. Despite this, I still like to think about BPSD clusters in my mind when I'm assessing patients. The clearest and best described being the psychotic cluster, of course. And more loosely associated are the symptoms in the affective cluster. And finally, at a push, I guess you could make an argument that there also exists sometimes what's referred to as the aberrant motor cluster. It is important also to mention that there are symptoms that do not cluster together. And these are the sleep and eating disturbances, as well as apathy. Slide 15. The final aspect I wanted to touch upon in the section deals with persistence. The question we always ask once a patient experiences a BPSD symptom is, what is the likelihood that it will naturally resolve versus persist? You can imagine having some sense would be very important for both the carer as well as the staff involved. So what do we know about persistence? Well, perhaps the best appreciated and saddest fact relates to apathy, which is recognized as being highly prevalent, highly persistent, and unfortunately is also fairly resistant to treatment. Wandering also tends to persist, as does mood disorders and irritability. This contrasts with psychotic symptoms, which generally don't persist for any duration, though on the other hand, they do tend to relapse. Slide 16. So let's move on to antipsychotics, which I'll try not to dwell on too long. But since the introduction of chlorpromazine in 1950, antipsychotics have been increasingly used globally to manage BPSD, and the prevalence has now become worryingly high. Typical antipsychotics have no role and are not recommended as there is essentially no benefit in this setting. Atypical antipsychotics have at best a modest effect, limited to some specific symptoms in the BPSD spectrum. A more nuanced discussion of this is unfortunately outside of the scope of this talk. My recommendations is that if you are considering using an antipsychotic, seek advice. The biggest and best trial is the clinical antipsychotic trial of intervention effectiveness in Alzheimer's disease, or the KTAD study. They managed to enroll 421 patients with Alzheimer's disease and BPSD, and randomized them to olanzapine, quetiapine, risperidone, or placebo. No significant differences were seen in their primary outcome of medication discontinuation, and no significant differences were seen in their secondary outcome of clinical global impression of change at 12 weeks. However, they did pick up significant increases in extrapyramidal side effects as well as sedation in both the risperidone and olanzapine groups. Slide 17. But no talk about antipsychotics and dementia can be complete without mentioning the FDA black box warning that was issued in 2005. And this was based on the pooled analysis of 17 randomized controlled trials by Schneider, which reported a 1.7 times increased risk of mortality due to excess strokes. Slide 18. Though this fundamentally changed our perception of using antipsychotics in BPSD, has it had the same effect in our practice? Well, this warning did slow growth in the use of atypical antipsychotics, but hasn't really reduced overall prescription rates, and similar trends were seen in Canada and Europe. This curb in growth has, however, been counterbalanced by a switch back to using conventional or typical antipsychotics, even though they have less proven efficacy and risk greater side effects. This was picked up by the FDA, who extended the black box warning to encompass all antipsychotics in 2007. Unfortunately, second time round, it has had a lesser impact on our prescribing habits. Slide 19. So what's the current state of play? This meta-analysis a few years ago by Wang did show a small but statistically significant benefit with olanzapine, risperidone, and aripiprazole, though as you can see, any benefits were largely negated by adverse effects. It's also worthwhile pointing out that those statistically significant benefits often equated to a 1 to 2 point difference on the neuropsychiatric inventory, which often don't translate into clinical significance, whilst adverse events like stroke, extrapyramidal side effects, sedation, and death generally are always felt to be clinically significant. So although it's technically correct to say atypical antipsychotics remain the best short-term treatment, i.e. less than 3 months, for aggression and agitation and dementia, its use really needs to be limited to those with severe, persistent distress after carefully weighing up the very real risks of treatment. Even when used, all efforts should be made to limit the dose as well as treatment duration. And ideally, we should only be seeing a very small minority of patients with BPSD on antipsychotics. Slide 20. Unfortunately, this message hasn't become embedded in our clinical practice, so in reality, antipsychotics continue to do much more harm than good. As an example, one study found only 10% of psychotropic use is fully appropriate. Patients also remain on these drugs for far longer than recommended, with more than 60% remaining on these agents longer than 6 months, despite no evidence for benefit after 3 months. Now, slide 21. Although we now recognize the majority of antipsychotics are inappropriately prescribed, there are significant barriers towards stopping these agents. The combined willingness between GP and nurses to stop these medications was only 4.2% in one study. And I really like how the researchers reported combined willingness, as this really highlights the team approach to care and alludes to the overall culture of care we work in. This dynamic was further demonstrated in the barriers the researchers identified, and as you can see, many of them were not actually related directly to the BPSD symptoms that patients were experiencing per se. Slide 22. I just wanted to briefly mention the other psychotropics used in BPSD before we summarize the section. Acetylcholinesterase inhibitors should be initiated before trialing other psychotropics. Though they have a modest effect at best, they may also delay cognitive and functional decline. SSRIs should be tried in the context of mood symptoms, and have also shown some effect in agitation, so there is some support for trialing these agents before antipsychotics as well. Finally, memantine, an NMDA inhibitor, can improve specific behaviour such as agitation and irritability, and is generally used in combination with acetylcholinesterase inhibitors for people with moderate to severe range dementia. Slide 23. So here's a table that summarizes the general approach as advocated by all the guidelines. And as you can see, SSRIs and cognitive enhancers are used in preference to antipsychotics. An alternative and more common approach, however, is the clinical one, which tries to best match the medication effects to the symptom profile. So, for example, an antipsychotic for psychotic symptoms and an antidepressant for low mood. So, although this approach is intuitive, none of the BPSD trials were designed to confirm that this approach was, in effect, the best approach. And secondary analyses in a lot of these trials suggests that it might not be. Slide 24. So I think the reason why we've gotten ourselves into the situation is because through a biomedical lens, we have come to see all behaviours in dementia as pathological, and this really compels us to then treat them. Yet up to 28.6% of elderly in residential care without dementia had significant neuropsychological symptoms when tested with the same instruments. So I guess what this suggests in my mind is that we will tolerate you as a grumpy old man, but we will not tolerate you as a grumpy, demented old man. The danger of judging all behaviours as dysfunctional when they fall outside our norms is not only that it drives the need to treat, but the aim of treatment is often simply to extinguish the behaviour. And from this perspective, if non-pharmacological approaches are used at all, then they are used on as add-on therapy rather than used as the primary approach. A more constructive alternate point of view, first proposed by Algaze 20 years ago, was instead to view all behaviours as driven by an unmet need. And this has become known as the needs-driven compromised behaviour model. It proposes all behaviour as being meaningful forms of communication that are coded or distorted by dementia. Our job is not necessarily to treat the behaviour, but recognise it simply as a cue, unlock the meaning behind the behaviour, and attend to these unmet needs. Slide 25. I've provided a schematic representation to help further understand needs-driven behaviours. So a person with dementia might well have significant background as well as more proximal factors that lead to a primary need. They then express this need in their primary behaviours. If this primary need is not met and the focus of treatment becomes the behaviour itself, or if there are personal, care, or contextual factors, then the person may develop secondary unmet needs, which then precipitate further behavioural responses. And so the cycle of BPSD can become self-perpetuating. Slide 26. It's easiest to illustrate this with a clinical example. So let's take Mr. S, whose background factors are that he is an 88-year-old man with dementia. He has never married, has no children, and been an avid tramper all his life. His proximal factors may well have been that his niece had recently arranged for him to move facilities to be closer to her. He struggled with this because he couldn't understand some of the staff, and also because of the change in his daily routines. His primary need might well have been the need for quietness, space, and access to outdoors, as well as dedicated one-on-one time with someone who could develop rapport and help orientate and adjust to the changes he's experiencing. However, this was not picked up, and staff documented increasing wandering, intrusiveness, and repetitiveness. This may have well represented a missed opportunity for identifying a primary unmet need. Anyway, his niece has gone away for the week, and it's now the weekend. Staff asked the locum GP for a review, and armed with the best information she has available, it seems a short-acting benzodiazepine and zopiclone are the most appropriate interventions. He seems to settle down for the first couple of nights, so these medicines are continued. However, as the week progresses, he becomes more sedated and confused. A further review is difficult to arrange, and anyway, things don't seem that urgent. However, his cares are becoming more difficult and stressful all round. He's now getting achy, dehydrated, constipated, because of immobility. You can see he's now developing secondary needs of mobilization, analgesia, hydration, and relief of constipation. These are not entirely picked up, and as a consequence, these secondary unmet needs lead to secondary behaviors. He now becomes combative and repeatedly calls out. A second review is finally organized and risperidone is chartered. Although the scenario, the way I've painted it, seems obvious and easily avoidable, I suspect occurs more commonly than we would truly like to admit. But I think that really is the key, what we would like to admit. Because what do we feel comfortable about admitting to when it comes to caring for people with dementia? Slide 27. Ageism, stigma, and disability. These are the things I feel most uncomfortable admitting to. Perhaps there are enough people here today who share these discomforts with me sufficiently to permit me the patience of dwelling upon them for a while. As a geriatrician, I feel ageism is silently pervasive in Western cultures, though it's received very little attention. It's uniquely directed against our future selves, and of the big three, the other two being sexism and racism, is the only one that is becoming more entrenched in our attitudes. Ageism manifests in the stigma we attach to the elderly, and it just so happens that one of the most feared and stigmatized diagnoses in society is dementia. They really have become our modern-day lepers. The last point I wanted to make in this section is disability and how embracing a disability framework as outlined in the UN Convention for Rights of People with Disability might finally lead to social justice. Unfortunately, the day has not yet come where dementia is recognized as a disability rather than a disease. Slide 28. I find the stereotype content model is a useful tool to describe ageism. So if you were to plot on one axis the level of competence you felt towards various groups of people, and on the other axis the warmth, then old people are typically grouped with the disabled and retarded. It's people we feel a great deal of warmth towards, but very little competence. Slide 29. Extrapolating this further and focusing on the upper left quadrant, then we see we have a predominantly paternalistic attitude to the elderly, who we want to help and protect on the one hand, yet exclude and demean on the other. The motivation underlying these actions is a feeling of pity, which we palliate through our prescribing practices. Slide number 30. These pervasive stereotypes inevitably lead to prejudice and stigma without us even being aware of it. Stigma in dementia is ubiquitous and has been demonstrated right from the patient themselves through their loved ones, the public in general, and especially the people working in dementia care. The professionals in our healthcare system further act to uphold and legitimise the stigmatisation. Slide 31. There's stigma even in the words we use when describing BPSD. These are some of the common ones that we often rattle off when we talk amongst ourselves. Mrs. Jones is disruptive, Mrs. Jones is disturbing, abusive, or Mrs. Jones is annoying. But what is it that we're really saying about Mrs. Jones? Slide 32. Either consciously or subconsciously, words shape our views and has an impact on the care we provide. This quote is taken directly from a patient with dementia and worth reading directly. That's such an important thing for people to realise that lots of times, you know, we've always been labelled as being violent or reacting inappropriately. But if people were to think deeper than that and see deeper than that, lots of times we're reacting to something is a trigger. Because they often joke about it, I'm going to be labelled as sexually inappropriate when I get into long-term care because I can't stand the heat and they're all so warm. I'm going to be in there and my children already know I'm going to remove my clothing because I'm hot. I will be labelled as sexually inappropriate, but it will be the heat. I don't really know what the answer is, slide 33. And I guess I am guilty myself of talking in such pejorative ways about my patients, but I do think we need to be more conscious of the words we use and try to adopt a more neutral terminology, avoid labelling or attributing blame, and avoid being judgmental when talking about each other. And, slide 34. So finally, the challenge of dementia might well be in getting it recognised as a disability as opposed to a disease. I fully believe dementia is a disability because the cognitive and psychological deficits directly leads to functional and societal limitations. And the fundamental importance of this is that disability is defined by society. We set the threshold in terms of how much we are willing to adapt and accommodate so as to integrate people with disabilities into our society. Additionally, if we start viewing dementia as a disability rather than a disease, then the focus finally shifts from treating an illness to supporting impairment. Unfortunately, the New Zealand Disability Strategy, which ratified the UN Convention, does not yet recognise dementia as a disability, though I hope it's just a matter of time. Slide 35. So it seems we really have become lost some way. The next few slides really looks at how we might return to a holistic approach to care, where we might be able to attend to all the various domains that people have. Slide 36. The first, a little background on holistic or patient-centred care. Now, this idea was first introduced into dementia care by Tom Kitwood, a geriatrician in the 1990s. And at the time, there was an intense ethical debate as to whether a person remains a person when they have dementia. The argument being that dementia robbed the very essence of personhood and rendered these people unbeings. Although this debate still smoulders, thankfully, I'm happy to say the majority of us now take the position that personhood has to be preserved, irrespective of how severe the dementia becomes. If not, then the ethical imperatives are lost and care is reduced to simple mechanics. Quite frankly, a meaningless life would then equate to meaningless care. And this is summarised in Kitwood's equation, where dementia equates to neurological impairment plus physical health status plus the person's biography plus our malignant social psychology. The challenge he posed was to see the person and not the disease in order to create a positive care environment. Unfortunately, nearly 20 years on, little clinical progress has been made. There's not even a consensus as to the components of person-centered care, and little empiric evidence has surfaced as to its effectiveness. Some critics say that the days of person-centered care are numbered, essentially because it fails to capture the true interdependencies of relationships. So although we understand why people with dementia need us, perhaps we have not yet understood why we need people with dementia. Slide 37. So the realization now is that it's all about relationships. And since Kitford, dementia care triads have been used to better understand and explain how these relationships work and why some of us care whilst others don't. In its simplest form, a dementia care triad comprises the patient with dementia, the carer, and the health professional. We know all triangular relationships are inherently competitive, with two members often pairing off against the third. If we're not aware of the nature of these relationships, then destructive collusions may be generated, especially if there are inherent power differentials. However, recognition of the triadic nature of dementia care allows us to attend not only to the needs of people with dementia, but also the carers, other staff, as well as ourselves, to ensure positive outcomes. And the ones listed on the right have all been demonstrated in research. Slide 38. So dementia care cannot be simply about patient-centered care, where the focus is just on the patient. It's about relationship-centered care, where everyone is looking out for each other, as well as themselves, as much as the patient. This creates not only the positive climate of care that Kitford dreamed of, but also a positive culture of care. Essentially, we need to value ourselves and each other as much as we are encouraged to value our patients. Slide 39. So is it so contentious in this day and age to say as clinicians our needs are just as important as patients and carers? If not, then how do we achieve it? Once again, several strategies have been developed, and I'll just mention one, the census framework, because this framework has been successfully rolled out in several dementia units in the UK. It captures six simple yet vital needs that have to be met, not only for patients and carers in the activities we engage in, but also challenges us to ensure these activities meet the same six needs we have as well as clinicians. Relationship-centered care, as an evolution of patient-centered care, represents perhaps the most realized form of holistic care yet. Slide 40. Now, knowing all of this, the fundamental question is, why is it that people who are the most vulnerable and least able to adapt are required to change their behaviours so as to better fit into societal norms and expectations? Shouldn't the work of adapting and changing behaviours come from those who are actually able to do so in order to meet the needs of the most vulnerable? Slide 41. The proof of this is borne out in multiple systematic reviews of non-pharmacological interventions where the best evidence for effectiveness always gravitates towards those aimed at carers and staff as opposed to those targeting the patient. And this brings us to the final section of this talk, where I'll give a brief rundown of non-pharmacological strategies. And like all good communicators, I'll first give you the bad news in small chunks before finishing off with the good news. Slide 42. So the unyielding criticism of non-pharmacological strategies has always been the very low quality of research in this field, and this has held it back quite considerably and meant that few people actually took it seriously. This trend finally seems to be reversing, and there are some signs the field is now maturing. One of these signs is depicted by this graph, which shows the exponential growth in literature over the past 20 years. It also shows the emergence of high-quality randomized controlled trials, as indicated by the white and light gray boxes. The plus and negative signs represent each positive and neutral outcome. Slide 43. As a consequence, there is now a consensus developing as to a standard, as to a standardized approach to all non-pharmacological therapies that can be used when implementing these strategies. And these eight steps are all simple yet integral to such an approach. Slide 44. But nonetheless, there is still much work to do. Despite the fact that non-pharmacological approaches are universally recommended in all dementia guidelines, the situation remains frustrating, as none of them endorse any specific interventions and no guidance is provided on implementation. Consequently, without any guidance or policy directives, these recommendations have sat on the back shelf and not really translated into clinical practice and become the standard of care. Slide 45. Hang on, what actually is the standard of care when it comes to non-pharmacological strategies? This naturalistic qualitative study describes the steps that clinicians go through in their assessment of people with dementia. Firstly, as mentioned earlier, there was a tendency to filter all behaviours through the lens of pathology. Recognising the person has dementia allowed staff to assign them a special moral status that assumed loss of insight into what was right and what was wrong. This absolved patients of any blame. In fact, any staff who did take patients' behaviours personally were thought of at best ignorant and at worst reprehensible. However, this moral privilege also led to an inherent vulnerability, as people with dementia could easily fall victim to callous or malicious care. The next step was how much meaning staff assigned to these behaviours. Often this wasn't done at all, as the dementia itself was felt sufficient to explain the behaviour. Even when staff attempted to understand the behaviour, dementia was always used as the underlying explanation and rationale. Following on from that, staff then characterised how challenging they felt the behaviour was based upon its intentionality, unpredictability, persistence, level of threat, and social appropriateness. And this led to a situation where only challenging behaviours became clinically noticed, whilst all other behaviours were essentially ignored. Importantly, this missed the opportunity of noticing and understanding the preceding sub-threshold behaviours. Clinical responses were thus based on reactive strategies to manage the immediate crisis, and these responses were necessarily often generic in nature and comprised mainly of redirection and distraction. Slide 46. But don't get me wrong, this study does not show uncaring staff, simply staff who are not provided with sufficient resources to manifest the care that they wished. And this further is supported by other studies, such as this one, which identified the main barriers towards implementing non-pharmacological strategies were the lack of care provided, provided for people who do the work of caring. Slide 47. I hope I haven't left you feeling too dejected with so much bad news, but I have just one piece of bad news, if you feel you can stomach it, and that really is the plethora of interventions that have been developed over the years. If you can think of it, trust you me, someone else has already bet you to it. I won't go through the list, but just a couple of my favourites worth pointing out are rocking chair therapy, enforced social activity with nurses. Let's move on. Slide 48. But in all seriousness, this has led to a profusion of interventions that even the experts find confusing to navigate. So, for example, if the unmet need you've identified was boredom, then there are at least 16 discrete interventions that you could choose from. As to which one will be effective would then amount to finding a needle in a haystack. Slide 49. But hang on, wait. What if you had slightly missed the mark and felt it was more loneliness rather than boredom as the unmet need? Well, if the patient truly was lonely, then there are at least 17 discrete interventions to choose from, which are all entirely different to those advocated for boredom. And I'm being a little bit facetious by pointing this out, but this is, in fact, the status of a lot of the literature when you read it. Slide 50. So finally, for some good news. It really is about being sensible and not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. An example of this has been an interest in dementia-friendly environments. A great deal of thought and work has been undertaken over the recent years. And what I really like about this is that they've been able to distill 10 simple recommendations, which are all quite intuitive, but in fact really reminds us of who it is we are building for. Slide 51. And finally, the last piece of good news. Though there is still a lot of work to do, there are some really promising results being reported from high-quality randomized controlled trials of non-pharmacological therapies. This study, though not directly related to BPSD per se, is an example of such research that's now being generated. So in this group, 61 patients were randomized to a structured multi-component intervention consisting of motor, ADL, and cognitive elements. The program was delivered for 2 hours each day, 6 days a week, over a 12-month period. The intervention group are in green, whilst the placebo group are indicated in blue. Their remarkable finding was that not only did the intervention lead to stabilization of cognitive scores and ADL independence, but 10 months after the intervention, 10 months later, the intervention group still showed significantly less deterioration than controls. I don't want to overstate it or make too much of it, but to me, this is almost like finding the holy grail of dementia care. The only question that remains is whether we will choose as a society to invest the resources needed to generate these sort of outcomes for all. Slide number 52. I truly hope the answer to that is yes, as I think about my future when I'm retired and am diagnosed with dementia. I wonder what my scrapbook or even Facebook page would look like. I think I would like to feel secure and have a sense that I belong and that my life still holds vital meaning. I want to be surrounded by people who know and love me, and be in a place that I know to be my home. I want to be supported to still achieve the things I enjoy doing and make meaningful connections to the world around me. Slide 53. So I would like now to invite you again to close your eyes and imagine yourself at 80. How would you feel? What would you still love to do? Who would still be there to care? Slide 54. So in conclusion, there are so many take-home points I could highlight. But I guess my final thoughts on moving towards a better approach in dementia care are that we remember we are caring for our future selves when we provide care to people with dementia, and to also remember that the person is always more important than their illness. And last but not least, be kind to ourselves and each other. So thank you for this time. I've really enjoyed compiling and presenting a topic that I feel passionate about, and hope that I have been able to impart and share just a little bit of wisdom with you all this morning. Thank you.